Yeah, good morning, everyone, and I hope that all of us together are preparing for the great day of Matan Torah that is coming right after Shabbat. And in a way, studying Kuzari is a very good way to prepare ourselves for Matan Torah, because you will recall that, as I said last week, and I'm sure Rabbi Wein said as well, although the Kuzari is always classified as a book of Jewish philosophy, it is one of the most anti-philosophical books almost ever written, because Rav Yehuda HaLevi repeatedly says that philosophical speculation will not bring a person to God, and what brings a person to God is the reality of historical experience. And that is to say, Matan Torah, Yetziat Mitzrayim, and the theory of the Kuzari, which again is a controversial theory, is that any religion that claims that God revealed himself in a supernatural way to everybody is a non-refutable claim, because it's impossible to make it up. I can make up that God appeared to me, and I could convince you of that fact, but I cannot make up the story that God appeared to you, and even if you're suggestible, I won't be able to convince a million people that God appeared to them. And therefore, the Kuzari said, you might call this the theory of audacity. The claim that Judaism makes is so audacious that it has to be true. Now, the Rambam, well, I don't want to call it plagiarized, because it was the Derech of the Rishonim. This is an interesting question, which I don't really have an answer for. You know, the Gemara makes a big point that you're always supposed to say things b'shem omro. That means that if you heard something from somebody, you're supposed to say, I heard it from so-and-so. And yet the Rishonim often did not follow that rule. The Rishonim freely did what we would call today plagiarism, by simply taking ideas from other authors and not necessarily giving them credit. The Rambam does that quite often. And in fact, the Rambam, who uses revelation as the cornerstone of Jewish belief, actually got the idea from Rav Yehuda HaLevi. Now, in the Rambam's defense, the Rambam says the following. It's a very interesting point. He says, many things that I say, I have gotten from other authors. He tells you ahead of time. Although, obviously, much of the Rambam is original as well. Don't get me wrong. But he says, I'm not going to identify the authors, because then you will give credence based on the author and not based on the content. You know how it is. The story goes, I'll give you a little maisa, that somebody once sang an old niggun in a Simchas Beis HaShoeva. And it really turned people off. People said, oh, why don't you just stop? It's a boring niggun. And then the person said, this is a niggun from Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Says, let's hear it again. Meaning, our nature is, you know, listen, somebody might tell you a thought and you'll dismiss it. As soon as you hear, there's a good name attached. So the Rambam actually said, the Rambam felt very strongly that ideas should be evaluated based on their content and not based on who said it. And therefore, the Rambam says, I'm not going to tell you who said things, so you will take the idea in on its merits. So because of this, the Rishonim freely engaged in a phenomenon that in modern times we would call plagiarism, but they actually considered it to be morally justifiable based on this consideration. Be it as it may, an idea that is often cited in the Rambam, that the Sinai revelation is the proof of Jewish belief, actually originated, well, actually, now that I think about it, even it wasn't even original with the Kuzari. I believe that the first person that said it was Rav Sadia Gaon. And the Kuzari said it without attribution to Rav Sadia Gaon, and the Rambam said it without attribution to either the Kuzari or Rav Sadia Gaon. So people borrow ideas because it becomes part of our Torah Hashkafah. This, as I say, though, for some reason, even though the Rav Sadia Gaon says it, and the Rambam says it, it is known as the Kuzari principle. Rav Yehuda HaLevi seems to get the greatest familiarity connected to this principle. And it is a controversial principle, and God forbid, I don't want to undermine it, but I do want to throw out a question that one needs to consider about the Kuzari principle. Rav Yehuda HaLevi makes the point that mass revelation could not be introduced by an individual. A man could not come someday and say, God appeared to all of you, or God appeared to your grandparents. Because then I would raise the question, well, if God appeared to my grandparents, why didn't they ever tell me? But that's his argument. You can't have a situation where the lie gets introduced, because as soon as the lie gets introduced, people are not going to accept it. So there must have been an unbroken tradition. So the question I want to raise, which is not my question, other people have raised it as well, is that there is evidence in Tanakh that there were times in Jewish history where the Torah was literally forgotten and was restored by only a very small number of people. Now the question is, if indeed we ever reached a state where most of the Jewish people did not have a memory of revelation, and that memory got restored by a small group of individuals, that fundamentally attacks the Kuzari thesis, because what that's saying is a small number of people can reintroduce. Well, here's the argument. If they can reintroduce something, then what's going to stop them from making it up? Right? The Kuzari's argument is it's not possible for a small number to introduce a mass revelation concept to the people, because they're going to say, how come we never heard this before? But that might have actually happened. Now let me give you the instances where there is some evidence of this. You may recall that towards the end of the first temple period, there was Chizkiyahu, that was a very righteous king, and during his days the northern kingdom of Israel was exiled, but Chizkiyahu was the melech in Yehuda. And remember the Gemara in Brachos, a famous Gemara, that Chizkiyahu did not want to get married because he saw with Ruach HaKodesh that he would have a Rasha. And the Navi Yeshayahu, Chizkiyahu got sick and he was going to die, and Yeshayahu the Navi told him, you are Chayav Misa because you're not Mekayim Pruervu. And Chizkiyahu said, I'm going to have a son that's a Rasha. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, it is none of your business to be concerned with secrets. And because of this, the Gemara tells us, in order to mitigate this gezeira of a Rasha, Yeshayahu gave Chizkiyahu his own daughter to marry. And lo and behold, unfortunately, the child that was born did become a Rasha. He became the king Menashe, who became king at the age of 12, and had the longest reign in Chol Yisrael. He ruled for 55 years, and Menashe is considered to be the epitome of a Rasha, although, I don't want to digress too much, there's a fascinating discrepancy in the book of Malachim versus the book of Divrei Hayamim. Right, there are parallel accounts. In the book of Malachim, Menashe is a Rasha mitchilaso v'yad sofa. Menashe, totally evil, irredeemable evil. In the book of Divrei Hayamim, we actually read that Menashe was taken hostage by one of the Babylonian kings, and he eventually was restored, and he became a Baal Tshuva for the last 20 years of his life. One of the most perplexing discrepancies between Malachim and Divrei Hayamim is whether Menashe did Tshuva. And how we answer that, it depends, but I once saw an explanation, a very fascinating explanation, which I'll throw out, it's not directly relevant to the Kuzari, is that Menashe's sins have two effects. He was a personal sinner, but because he was a melech, he created an atmosphere of lawlessness and rebellion against God. Now, when he did tshuva, he was able to rectify his personal averos, but he was not able to rectify the spiritual chorban he affected in Klal Yisrael. And therefore, the book of Malachim is describing Menashe as king. Malachim. As king, he died a Rasha, because the damage he did to the nation, he was unable to rectify. Divrei Hayamim speaks about Menashe as an individual. As an individual, he did tshuva. This is a fundamental problem. Whenever you're a chotei umachti as a rabbin, when you sin, but you also cause others to sin, you know, it's very difficult to do tshuva, because you can do tshuva in terms of the bad things I did. But what about the effects on other people? Menashe created an atmosphere within Kal Yisrael of sin, of rishis, of avodah zarah. I mean, all of those things that we say. The first temple was destroyed because of avodah zarah, gilui arayos, shvichas damim. This occurred during the reign of Menashe and afterwards. Okay. But vis-a-vis the Kuzrik, because I'm bringing this in, this is, again, very interesting. I think it's a very interesting point, but it's peripheral. But I'm bringing this in for the following. Menashe had a son who was also a Rasha, Amon, right? Like father, like son. But miraculously, the grandson of Menashe, who became king at the young age of 8 years old, somehow was a righteous person, even as a child. His teacher was Chilkiyahu HaKohen, who was actually Yirmiyahu's father, Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu, and the like. And Yoshiyahu tried to bring Klal Yisrael back to tshuva, and he served Hashem b'chol levavo b'chol nafsho. He was tragically killed before he completed his mission, and indeed it is brought down that the fourth chapter of Eicha, Eicha Yuam Zahav, how has the gold been dimmed, is not about the Churban Beis HaMikdash. It is about the death of Yoshiyahu, because Yirmiyahu included it in Eicha. Because Yirmiyahu knew with Ruach HaKodesh, with Nevuah, had Yoshiyahu lived, and he would have been successful in his mission, the Churban Beis HaMikdash could have been averted. In fact, Yoshiyahu could have been Mashiach. That could have been the end of all Golos and all Churban. But in the book of Malachim, it is recorded that Yoshiyahu turned to God with all of his heart and all of his soul, and he ordered that there be repairs made in the Beis HaMikdash, because it had become a decrepit structure. And as they're going through the Beis HaMikdash, they clear away the debris, they find a Sefer Torah. Now the simple meaning of the Psukim is really an amazing thought. That Menashe's reign, like the Soviet Union, was so ruthless in uprooting Yiddishkeit, that there was literally no Sefer Torah in Eretz Israel. No one knew of the Torah. No one remembered the Torah. No one kept the Torah. And lo and behold, they found the Sefer Torah. Now, if you take this story literally, and I'll give you an alternative explanation, you do have a theological problem with the Kuzari principle. Because essentially, you're positing a nation that has forgotten about God and about God's Torah. And you have a king and a small group of people, Chilkiyahu HaNavi, who come back and tell the people, this is God's Torah! And the people believe them. But you understand the question. Once revelation can be introduced by an individual, you no longer have the guarantee of its authenticity, because the Kuzri's whole argument is, an individual couldn't make up the story. So it had to have happened, but an individual restored the story. So it's a problematical thing. But let me point out that if you look in the book of Malachim, many, many Mephorshim, now Rehuda Levi unfortunately does not give us his own take on the story, so it's hard to know, but many Mephorshim learn the story very differently. They do not learn that there were no Sifrei Torah in Am Yisrael. They do not learn that the Torah was forgotten. Yes, many, many people didn't keep the Torah, but people knew what the Torah said. People remembered the revelation. The story was different. The miracle was not that they found a Sefer Torah. There were plenty of Sefer Torah. The miracle was a much more specific miracle, that the Torah was opened to a specific pasuk. They didn't find a rolled up Torah. They found an open Torah scroll. And the open Torah scroll was open to the tochacha. That if you don't keep the mitzvos, God is going to bring, we read it last week, God will bring galut and churban. So based on that, the story of Yoshiyahu is no longer a contradiction to the mass revelation theory, because indeed, like this pshat, mass revelation had never been forgotten. In other words, it was not reintroduced by individuals, right? So that's the point. Again, I'm bringing this up because I think it's an important point, and also, in the blogosphere, which I'm sure none of you participate in, but in the blogosphere, you will often see the story of Yoshiyahu as an attack on the Kuzari principle. And I just want to point out that if you learn the Rishonim on the story of Yoshio, you will see an alternative explanation which does not undermine the principle. So that's important to be aware of. But in the fifth, so basically, as I say, the Kuzari makes the point almost sarcastically: if philosophical speculation brings a person to God, then how come I don't see so many philosophers who are prophets? He says, obviously, philosophy does not bring you to prophecy. Again, it's an interesting point. Rav Yehuda HaLevi, as the Rambam did as well, had a great fascination with prophecy in a way that we don't really have today. You see, we, maybe because we're so practical, we look at prophets in a very utilitarian sense. Oh, a prophet tells me the future. A prophet tells me what we're supposed to do, even spiritually. Right? We look at prophecy as kind of God has a message, so God sends the message through prophets. The Kuzari has a very different image of prophecy. Prophecy is not so much about messages, although a prophet will be given messages. Prophecy is about a state of spiritual cleaving to divinity. It is Dveikus Bashem. It is the soul that is reuniting with its source. And once you're united with God, so memela, God will give you messages and the like. But the essence of Nevuah, the Kuzari learns, is not the message. The essence of Nevuah is what is called, at least in the Ibn Tibbon translation, I don't know the Arabic, Inyan Eloki, the concept of connecting to God. And that is why the Kuzari says the hallmark of a true religion is whether it brings its adherence to prophecy. And if it brings it to prophecy, that means it connects you to God. If it does not bring you to prophecy, it does not connect you to God. And therefore the Kuzari makes the point that every Jew is capable of prophecy. And if you're not a prophet, when you speak to a prophet, you will be elevated into the prophetic realm. The Kuzari says, every time you speak to a Navi, you will be elevated to that highest level. The Kuzari points out that Eretz Yisrael is mesugal for Nevuah. He says every country has its natural crop. Some countries are best for wheat and for rice and for tobacco. Well, tobacco he didn't mention because in his day there was no tobacco. I was going to say corn. There was no corn either. Right? Those are North American products. But he mentions wheat and rice and barley. Eretz Yisrael, too, has its natural crop. The natural crop of Eretz Yisrael is Nevuah. Now, Nevuah stopped. We're not worthy. But he basically says that that's because that's the state of being in Galut. Even in Eretz Yisrael, you're in Galut. But the natural condition of the Jew is to be Muchan le-Nevuah. So you have to understand that when the Kuzari talks about Nevuah, it is not at all simply, oh, it's good to get messages from God regarding who's going to win the war, although that's obviously important. But Nevuah refers to Dveikut. And that's why the Kuzari makes a fascinating point that a Jew, on one hand, is not afraid of death because our souls will be connected with God. But, he says, a Jew does not yearn for death because even in this physical world, we can achieve a cleaving to God through Nevuah. So the Jew has no fear of death, but at the same time, a Jew understands that Olam Haba is realizable in some degree, even in Olam Hazeh. So this role of Nevuah is a very, very significant point in the Kuzari. He talks about Inyan Eloki. There is one thing the Kuzari says, though, that's extremely controversial. And again, I say it with all apologies to anyone that might be hurt, and I also want to say at the outset, before I even say what the idea is, that the Rambam strongly disagrees with this idea. This is a big machlokas, the Rambam and the Kuzari. The Kuzari says that the Jewish soul is fundamentally greater, but not just greater in quality, but greater in kind. He creates a hierarchical system of creation. We know that if you divide the matter of the universe, we have four categories. And this goes back to Aristotle. We have domain, which is the inanimate, stones, metal, minerals. We have the tzomeach, the vegetative. We have the chai, the animal soul. And then we have the human soul, which is human is not just an animal. The human is called midaber, the capacity of speech. But again, you have to understand, speech doesn't just mean talking. After all, if a person is mute, they can't talk, but it refers to essentially the abstract thoughts that can then be articulated in speech. These are not simply higher and lower. These are different kinds of beings. There is the inanimate being, there is the vegetative being, there is the animal being, there is the human being. We do not regard human beings as a species of animal. We regard human beings as having the divine soul, the Tzelem Elokim. All of this is very familiar. But the Kuzari tells, the Chaver, the rabbi, tells the kings of the Khazar, because Kuzari is the name of the king. The Chaver tells the Melech HaKuzar that the Jew is not simply a superior human being. A Jew is a fifth category of creation. Just as there are Medaber, there is Kedushat Yisrael. And in the hierarchy of creation, the Yisrael is a qualitatively different species than is a regular, another person. Again, as I say, the Rambam, I mentioned this in another talk two nights ago, the Rambam doesn't seem to go in that direction. The Rambam seems to go with the idea, you are what you do. You're good, you're righteous, so you're pure. You're not righteous, you're not. There's no automatic freebie because you were born a Jew, you're somehow superior. Okay, that's not true. The Rambam, we might call it, was a strict meritocracy. Your connection to God is a function of how righteous you are, and there's no particular distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. And if anything, it's harder to be a righteous Jew because you have more obligations. This is the Rambam. And in a sense, although the Rambam has been accused of being an elitist because he says that only a few people are truly gifted and capable of truly comprehending God, but on the other hand, he's also an egalitarian because he kind of says, like, everybody stands equal before God. Your value depends on what you do. Rav Yehuda HaLevi has a dramatically different conception. Rav Yehuda HaLevi's conception is, and again, I apologize if this offends, I'm just conveying his teaching, his position. The Jew is better. Now, that doesn't mean a Russia gets a freebie. Obviously, precisely because the Jewish neshama is higher, there is greater accountability, the onshim are greater, the punishments are greater. Rav HaLevi, of course, talks about that. But he says there is the quality of the Jewish soul that is not just a higher soul, but a different soul. It is a different soul, a soul that is capable of nevuah. A nevuah cannot exist among the Umot HaOlam, although there was one exception. Bilam, God had to break the rules to give the Umot HaOlam one navi. But nevuah cannot exist be Umot HaOlam simply because the Inyan HaElokei is shayach only for Yisrael. Now again, as I say, some people have accused the Kuzari's philosophy as being racist, gazanut. I don't want to get into that. You can make your own judgment. I'm not here to tell you what to think about this. But a cornerstone of Yehuda HaLevi's philosophy is the inherent superiority of the Jewish soul. Now again, I do want to emphasize, one has to understand one important thing. Regardless of this superiority, the one thing it does not mean and cannot mean is that other people are treated with a lack of respect. It has never authentically been interpreted that way. that a Jew treats every human being with kavod, with derech eretz, with the recognition that they are made in the image of God. Okay, so it's very important that when people sometimes say, oh, according to Rabbi Halevi, you know, this is just Aryan philosophy translated to the Jewish people. The answer is no, because precisely because of our chosenness, God gave us responsibilities. And those responsibilities include kindness to the Ummah, to Olam, and the like. So it's very important to understand, Rabbi Halevi was not at all, God forbid, heaven forbid, advocating any type of Nazi Aryanism. But he does talk about the superiority of the Jewish soul, the Inyan Eloki. Again, the Rambam, I think, would differ with him on this very important point. But here is the thing that I do want to apologize ahead of time. He does say there is actually a genetic basis in the holiness of this neshama coming from Avram Avinu. And therefore, he makes the point. This is one of the most controversial, but I want to be open and honest with you in terms of what the Kuzari says. He makes the point that although a ger who joins the Jewish people will get the reward for the mitzvos and become part of us, he says a ger cannot reach the highest level of nevuah. Nevuah is only to those that have the unbroken. Now, the truth of the matter is, for most of us, this is a highly theoretical distinction, because the vast majority of Jews, I include myself, we're not going to be nevuah either. So to say to the ger, hey, you can never be a navi. Well, the ger could look at me and say, well, you probably won't be one either. So it may not make much of an operational distinction, but it is a conceptual distinction. Now again, I do want to point out that number one, the Rambam disagrees, because the Rambam says nevuah is not a function of genetics, nevuah is a function of spiritual work, and therefore nevuah is open to everybody. But number two, there's another way to analyze this, and this depends how you understand conversion as a process. And this goes back to the notion, Rabbi Halevi's argument is that a ger who comes from the outside did not have a Jewish soul, and therefore is not muchan l'nevuah. Well, is that so obvious? If you look in later Kabbalistic literature, we see at least two different understandings of the Jewishness of the ger. Understanding one is that every soul of someone who converts to Judaism was a soul that was mekabel the Torah at Har Sinai. What do we mean by this? Because the Gemara tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu offered the Torah to every nation, and the nations turned it down until he got to the Jewish people. But when they turned down the Torah, they didn't do so 100%. Maybe 51-49. So what happened to those minority people who wanted to accept the Torah, but they were outvoted by a majority? So according to some sources, they were zocha to have their neshamos at Har Sinai to be mekabel the Torah. And although it may be hundreds, if not thousands of years until those neshamas come back, those were the same neshamas. Like our neshamas were at Har Sinai, their neshamas were at Har Sinai. That's one point. Another point is a little different. Another point is a ger, which means according to that analysis, the neshama of a ger was kind of already Jewish. It was already Jewish before the conversion. And the conversion was simply to make, bring the guf in line with the neshama. That's one model of conversion. Neshama Jewish, guf not Jewish. That's why you'll find, you know many gerim will often say that even if they grew up in North Dakota or Montana or a place where there were no Jews that they knew of, they had from young childhood a fascination and a striving to know something about Yiddish. And where did it come from? It didn't come from a teacher. It didn't come from anybody. But their neshama was pushing them. That's one model. There is another model which leads to the same conclusion by a different route, and that is the immersion of a non-Jew in a mikveh kills off the old neshama and they get a new, fresh neshama from Shemayim. And they emerge from the mikveh a newly born person. That actually fits the paradigm halacha that a ger shenitzgayer is like a newborn. So either of those models might lead, I'm just giving this as a speculation, might lead to a conclusion different than the Kuzari. Whether you say the non-Jew who converts already had a Jewish neshama, or whether you say they get a Jewish neshama, there is the theoretical possibility at this point, they're muchan linevuah. So one can approach this in two ways. One can either say, like the Rambam, that nevuah is not limited to Jews anyway. Even a pure guy could get nevuah if he was righteous. That's the Rambam's approach. The other approach is that nevuah is limited to Jews, but the ger either had a Jewish soul, or the ger got a Jewish soul, and therefore they could be muchan l'nevuah. This would be the approaches unlike Rav Yehuda Halevi, but Rav Yehuda Halevi himself does say that a non-Jew who converts, although they are part of Am Yisrael, they are not able to have nevuah. So again, I apologize if it hurts, but as I say, I will not be a Navi either, most of us will not be, so perhaps it's theoretical. And it is based on controversial, again, some of the Kuzari is controversial, and we have to be honest. It is based on what you might call a racial superiority of the Jewish neshama, but I do want to emphasize over and over again, this was never used to denigrate, or it should not be used to denigrate others, because that itself is a great violation of the ethics of Judaism. In fact, interestingly enough, let me just share with you a Mishnah. The Mishnah says in Maseches Gittin that we are obligated to give charity and sustain the poor of the Ovdei Kochavim. That even means idol worshippers, not just non-Jews, idol worshippers. We must take care and give tzedakah to idol worshippers. And as I say, many, many non-Jews are not idol worshippers. In fact, Arabs, as bad as they are in many other areas, are not of the Avodah Zarah. But even idol worshippers, we give tzedakah, and the reason that's given is darchei shalom. Fascinatingly, there is an argument between Rashi and the Rambam. What is darchei shalom? Now Rashi uses it as a particularistic ethic. Rashi kind of says, well, you better be nice to the non-Jews, because if you're not nice to the non-Jews, they're going to be bad to you, and you're going to get in trouble when your house is burning down. Therefore, be nice. So according to Rashi, it is not a moral value intrinsically. It is a utilitarian value to protect your self-interest. That is what Rashi says. But the Rambam says very differently. The Rambam says the essence of darchei shalom is an expression of imitatio dei. Imitatio dei is Latin. Imitate the ways of God. God has compassion and love for all that he creates. And if it is the Jewish mission to emulate the ways of God, we must have compassion and love for all that God has created. And therefore, according to the Rambam, darchei shalom is not simply saying, be nice so they won't hurt you. Darchei shalom is an affirmative ethic within Judaism that we must respect the dignity. In fact, the phrase, some people are offended by this, but I am perfectly happy with it. They're talking about the Judeo-Christian ethic. Okay, I mean, the notion that in Genesis, the Torah says, man and woman, the human being, was created in the image of God. That's a fundamental cornerstone. The Christians got it from us. But the cornerstone of Jewish ethic is that every human being is in the image of God. Now here, I'm going to give you a semantic distinction that I think is very important. And that is, I just made a statement, and you might question me on this. Every human being is made B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God. Well, it's true that that's written by Adam HaRishon, right? But some people say, well, but the Jewish people took that over, and it's no longer B'Tselem Elokim. Well, I'll prove from a Mishnah that B'Tselem Elokim does apply to all human beings, even Goyim. And I'll prove it from two statements of Rabbi Akiva. In Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Akiva says the following, Chaviv Adam Shenivra Bitzelem. Beloved is man who was created in the image of God. Now, that itself is ambiguous. Maybe Adam means Yisrael, but no. Second statement, Chavivin Yisrael Shenikra'u Banim Lamakom. Beloved are the Jewish people because they are called the children of God. Now, it seems logical that Adam in the first phrase cannot refer to the Jews because then it would have said Chaviv in Yisrael as it says in the second phrase. So the juxtaposition of Adam and Yisrael seems to suggest that Rabbi Akiva's first statement is not limited to Jews, but all human beings are in the image of God. The Jewish people have a unique distinction. We are banim. We are children. We have that father-child relationship. Now, so because of this, I think we can reasonably conclude that the Tselem Elohim applies to everybody. Now, what does it mean, Tselem Elohim, of course? Tselem Elohim does not mean, in fact, image is probably not even the right word, because image connotes some visual image, and God, of course, does not have physicality. But Tselem here, as the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim, refers to moral and spiritual characteristics. Autonomy, free will, creativity, capacity to do great things. And I look at a human being and I see their inherent dignity because they were made in the image of God. However, here is where the Kuzari would add a little bit or differ or depart a little bit. Although all human beings are in the Tselem Elohim, but the notion of the divine soul, there is a special measure of divine soul that is vouchsafed only to the Jewish people, right? That's the Gazonut part of the Kuzari, and as they say, it is very, very controversial. But to some degree, I want you to remember the audience that he's addressing. It's interesting, I saw this, that Rav Yehuda, I mentioned this last week, but I want to add a thought. Rav Yehuda Levi was always a religious Jew. As far as we know, there was never a time when he was not a Shomer Mitzvot. But Rav Yehuda Levi was a bit of an assimilated person as a young man. A lot of his poetry, he wrote tremendously beautiful religious poetry, but you know, he also wrote love songs about wine, women, you know, and the like. And, you know, we don't study those in yeshivas too much, as far as I know. You know, we don't have the collection of Rav Yehuda Halevi's poems. But he wrote poems that we might consider a little risque, and, you know, certainly a Ben Torah doesn't write such things, and the like. And, essentially, in his youth, he was a proponent of the good life. You know, you could... I won't say a good modern Orthodox Jew from New Jersey. In other words, kind of, you know, you can go to Shul on Shabbos and daven, and then you can go to the Broadway plays and kind of enjoy all of this life. But as he grew older, he seemed to have entered a period of disenchantment and even depression, because he saw the people around him who were getting more and more assimilated, and even if they weren't leaving Judaism, internally they were leaving Judaism. Maybe they were keeping the forms, but they were not connected to God in that feeling. There was no dveikut, there was no passion. And he became very, very disenchanted with this idea of you can combine the secular life and the religious life. And in many, many ways, the Kuzari is a renunciation of his own past. Speaking to an assimilated population of Jews, some of whom left the Derech, and some of whom were going through the motions, but they really were not connected. Their passion was elsewhere. And that is why, again, I mean, I don't want to psychoanalyze Arisha, but that is why I think he felt so strongly about emphasizing these themes, because he's really talking to himself. He says, I look at this culture out there with its magnificent philosophy, and its science, and its pleasures, and its hedonism, and its architecture, and its art. And I see it's a distraction. And that is why, you know, this is towards the end of his life, and this is shortly before he chucked it to move to Eretz Yisrael. This actually happened. Now, the end of the Kuzri actually has the king, not the king, the rabbi, moving to Eretz Yisrael. That is exactly what Rav Yehuda Levi is about to do. So in some ways, again, I'm reluctant because, it's not for us to be psychoanalysts of someone who died 1,000 years ago. But in some ways, if you understand these struggles Rav Yehuda Levi is going through, this is why certain ideas are articulated. In other words, Jewish pride, looking at the Torah as the way to connect to God, moving away from emphasis on pleasure and on intellectual philosophy even. And in fact, he says, in the fifth mimer, I'm going ahead a little bit, in the last mimer, he makes a very, very beautiful point coming from the mouth of a poet. And it's interesting that you see his poetic disposition. You see his poetic disposition throughout the book. He repeats over and over, at least 15 times in the Sefer, how philosophy will not take you where you need to go again. He says this over and over and over again. But then he gives a very, very striking metaphor. He says, there are people who know all the rules of grammar and all the rules of diktuk and the like and all the rules of poetry and rhyme and meter, but they're not able to write a poem. Then there are people who intuitively have the feelings and the rhythm of language, and they're able to express the beauty of thought, but they can't explain to you exactly what it is that they're doing. Think about how a baby learns language, and think about how adults learn languages, right? If you come to Ulpan, you gotta learn Diktuk and Binyamin, right? A baby doesn't learn, whether it's English, Hebrew, whatever language it is. A baby just picks up language, he hears the language, he absorbs the language, it's part of his kishkes. The baby couldn't tell you what's a subject, what's a verb, what's a predicate, nominative, what's a gerund, what's an adjective, what's an adverb. Because when it's really part of you, you're not always able to articulate what it is. And the idea that, she makes a point, the capacity to articulate in a linear, logical way is only when you're somewhat distant from the actual phenomena. And therefore, he makes a point that a prophet might not be able to communicate what the experience of Dveikut really is. It's an uncommunicable type of state. Yeah, the philosopher can describe it because the philosopher is not experiencing it. Somebody once said about, Professor Gershon Scholem was a great professor at Hebrew University. He happened not to be a religious person, but he was considered to be one of the great scholars of Kabbalah. Historian of Kabbalah, he actually uncovered many Kabbalistic works and the like. And again, as I say, for basic history of Kabbalah and the basic ideas, he still is a very valuable source, although the newer generation has disputed a lot of his conclusions, Moshe Idol and the like. But somebody once said about Gershon Scholem, and I don't want to be sarcastic, I'm just quoting what somebody once said about him. He says, Gershon Scholem in Kabbalah is like an accountant. He knows where all the money is, but he doesn't have any of it. And you can be a scholar in a field, but it's not in you. And Rav Yehuda Levi says, philosophers have all these ideas. They're like the people who know all the rules of grammar, but are not able to write poetry. And some people can write poetry, and they don't know the rules of grammar. Very, very striking metaphor coming out of his own poetic experience, right? We have rhythms. In fact, they say that that's actually the definition of true proficiency, is you don't have to think in anything. When you don't have to think, you can kind of do things automatically. Because if you have to think, if you're playing the piano, you have to think, I go here, now I do a C, now I do a D. You can't play a piece. It has to be enough part of you that you just go ahead and do it. So this is Rav Yehuda Levi's point about his intense pride in the Jewish people. Again, a pride that some have accused of racism in some ways, but this is what it is. He was not an apologist. He said, Jews are better. But there's another part of the Kuzri that is a countertext, right? You have text and countertext. And that is the following. On one hand, we have these four levels of creation. The hierarchical scheme of creation, and the Jewish people are level number 5. a different level of creation. In fact, this is his answer. Now the king asks him, wouldn't it have been more fair if God would have made everybody capable of this divine connection? And Reuven HaLevi says, that's like asking the question, why didn't God make animals human? You know, in other words, the same thing. To say, why didn't God make everybody with this unique neshama? Because if you would say, everybody's human, but Jews have a greater capacity for something, you could ask the question, well, it's not fair that some human beings have a capacity that other human beings don't. But if the Jew is regarded as a separate level of creation, asking why didn't God make the non-Jew capable of being a Jew is the same question as asking why didn't God make the dog capable of being a non-Jew. it's a different level of creation, and hierarchically, this is what, you know, God created. But there's a counterpoint that you need to keep in mind. Reuven HaLevi points out in a different part of the Kuzari that if you take the four levels of creation and they fail to fulfill their function, the higher the level, the more repulsive it is. So, for example, a rock. A whole rock and a crushed rock. No, a crushed rock doesn't disgust me. But if you look at a plant that is no longer growing is a rotten plant. It could smell, it could putrefy. But a dead plant is not as repulsive as a dead animal. And a dead animal is not as difficult to deal with as a dead human being, a corpse that, God forbid, decomposes. So what do you see? You see that the higher the function, the more repugnant it is when it's not living up to its function. So a dead plant is worse than a rock. A dead animal is worse than a plant. A dead human is worse than a dead animal. So he says, a dead Jew, meaning a person that's alive but he's not living as a Jew, could become a more miastika thing, a more repulsive type of thing than a non-Jew, etc. So it's interesting that it does have a cost. In fact, that is why the laws of Tumah, the laws of ritual impurity, are stricter for Jewish corpses than for non-Jewish corpses. According to many opinions, not all, a Kohen is allowed to go into a non-Jewish cemetery. A Kohen is not allowed to go into a Jewish cemetery. Because the greater the Kedusha, the greater the desecration when that Kedusha is lacking. In fact, you know, adjacent to the Kidron Valley, to Har HaZeitim, right, we have the Shar HaZahav, the Golden Gate, you know, to the Har HaBayit, that's closed up. So you'll, Shar HaRachamim, so you'll notice, right, there's a small Islamic cemetery that goes right up to the gate. So legend has, I don't know if it's true, the Arabs knew all the Midrashim. We should know the Midrashim as good as they know all the Midrashim. Muhammad himself was fascinated with Midrashim. In fact, Muhammad wanted to convert to Judaism. He was turned down, so he started his own religion. But he actually wanted to become Jewish because he loved Midrashim. He was never big in halacha. I don't think Muhammad learned any Gemara. But he loved stories. He had a big imagination. So they know, the Arabs know that there was a Masorah that a Mashiach will make his entry from Har HaZeitim through Nachal Kidron through Shar Rachamim, and they know that 3 days before Mashiach, Eliyahu HaNavi announces his coming, and Eliyahu HaNavi is Pinchas, is a reincarnation of Pinchas, who is a Kohen. So they know that Kohanim cannot go through a cemetery, so they figure they'll put a cemetery right by Shar HaRachamim, and that will disable Pinchas Eliyahu from coming, and therefore Mashiach is not going to come. So halachically, however, the Arabs might be making a mistake, because many opinions do say a Kohen is allowed to go through a non-Jewish cemetery. And besides, you know, if they think that's going to be enough to stop Mashiach, you know, there's quite a lot of things Hashem could do that would upset that particular plan. But this is the story of why the cemetery is by the Shar HaRachamim and the like. But again, this is a sobering reminder that the chosenness of the Am HaNivchar creates some awesome responsibilities, which if we fail to live up to, we are much more accountable than Umot HaOlam, who failed to live up to their responsibilities. And this is why, indeed, the Midat HaDin is Metucha on Am Yisrael more than any other nation of the world. I mean, many nations of the world engage in all sorts of perversity, and, you know, nothing much may happen to them in the short run, the Jewish people, although the miracle of our survival is a true miracle, absolutely. You know, Rabbi Yaakov Emden writes that the survival of the Jewish people is a greater miracle than Yitziat Mitzrayim and Kriyat Yamsuf and the like. But still, the things that happen to us are kind of unbelievable. And that's the idea that those who are chosen by God have greater responsibility. So chosenness is not an excuse to sit on our laurels. It is a great, challenge. Okay. So this is the Kuzari's idea of the hierarchical order of creation. So as he goes on and on talking about the superiority of the Jewish soul, so the king gets a little irritated. You know, again, Reed Halevi is putting words into the king, and the king says things like, "I like the first things that you said, I don't like this so much." And then he says, "Hey, you're so great, what about the golden calf? You know, I heard, you know, that, you know, God takes you out of Mitzrayim, and a short time later, you worship this golden calf. How could that be?" And Reb Yehuda Halevi first says the following. He says, you know, happy is the person whose sins can be numbered. Meaning to say, yeah, Klal Yisrael has a few biggies, but you can count them on one hand. He says, you know, it's pretty good that, you know, you can count the Averis. Like, you know, it says, happy is the person whose sins can be numbered. But he then goes through a famous exposition of the Chet HaEgel. And this is actually a classic exposition that was taken up by virtually all the later Mefarshim, especially Ramban, who's Ma'arich on it much more. And that is, the Kuzari says, and this is his Yesod, that the sin of the golden calf was not a sin of idolatry. They did not believe that this calf, which they created, somehow created the world or took them out of Egypt even. That even though they said, we'll see, these are your gods, Israel, Asher Halucha. What do you mean? This is the God that took me out of Egypt? You just made it. You just made it a minute ago. So the Kuzari says, obviously that's not what's going on. What's going on is an idea that we don't fully understand. And that is, the Jewish people made a theological mistake. And it was a mistake and it was a sin. But it was not idolatry. They believed in the God that created heaven and earth, that was the one God that took them out of Egypt and did Kriyas Yamsuf and did the Ten Makos, and they absolutely believed in that. They believed in the revelation they heard at Sinai, I am the Lord your God that took you out of Egypt. But they wanted a visual medium to connect to him. Because when Moshe was with them, Moshe served as the spiritual channeler, the one that was able to receive divine force and pass it on. And they're concerned because Moshe's not here, right? Well, the idea was Moshe went up to Sinai for 40 days, and the 17th of Tammuz was the 40th day, and Moshe was supposed to come down, and Moshe did not come down until later in the day. They miscalculated. According to the Midrashim, the Satan gave them an image of Moshe dying. You know, Moshe was on a funeral bed, and the like, whatever it would be. And if you look in the Pasuk, it's clear that the Egel was a Moshe substitute, not a God substitute, because they said, Kum asei lanu Elohim, let us make, or Elohim, let us make a divine force. Asher yelchu lefaneinu ki zeh Moshe ha'ish, Moshe the man, not Moshe the God. Lo yadanu mehayoma. And they perceived of Moshe as an intermediary and as a channeling force of spiritual energy. And therefore they wanted the Tavnit of the Shor to be a channeler of spiritual energy so that godliness would be reflected. Now we don't understand the concept so much, but Rav Yehuda Halevi says, in our own spiritual lives, we utilize symbols to bring in divinity, whether it's a Beit Knesset, an Aron HaKodesh, a Sefer Torah. We use tangible visual symbols as mechanisms to induce us to be closer to God. And they looked at the ego as that type of symbol. Now, Ramban adds a few details to this Kabbalistically. Ramban points out that mystically, in the Kisei HaKavod of God, there are four faces on the Kisei HaKavod. This is the Perek Aleph of Yecheskel, which we're going to read this morning. This is the Haftorah, the Masa Merkava, the Divine Chariot, where you have the face of the ox, and the face of the eagle, and the face of the lion, and the face of the Adam, which is said to be Yaakov Avinu. And each face brings spiritual energy in certain environments. So the Ramban points out that the Hashpa'ah, again, I'm just saying words, I can't say I understand them, the Hashpa'ah, the divine influence that is mediated through the face of the shore, is Mesugal Lahochei Midboriot, for those in the deserts, because cattle can survive in desert environments, and therefore they wanted to channel a specific mechanism of spiritual energy that would lead them in the desert. However we understand this, Rav Yehuda Levi says, the Chet HaEgel was not Avodah Zarah, it was the mistake of utilizing an intermediary as opposed to turning to God directly. And then he makes the point, and even with that, it was only 3,000 people who worshiped the ego. 3,000 out of 600,000 men, and if you count the women and the people below 20, you get 3 million. So 3,000 is a very small number, and although indeed all of Am Yisrael is accountable based on the idea of Kol Yisrael Arevin, Zeh L'Zeh, but the Kuzari says, you know, number one, the ego wasn't idolatry, and number two, it was a small number of people who worshipped the ego. He then mentions a fascinating point about Aharon, which is taken up by later commentaries, not always mentioning the Kuzari. I had heard this thought much, much later, but I see the Kuzari says it as a throwaway line. And that is, okay, but what about Aharon? Aharon actually builds the ego. How can he do that? Aharon is righteous. Aharon is the co-leader. So Rashi learns, right? Rashi's understanding is that Aaron's attempt was to delay, right? Aaron said, give me your jewelry, because he figured the men wouldn't do it, but then they did it, so it's forfallen. But the Kuzari says a fascinating idea, which, you know, you might not get if you just read it, because he only says it in six words. He says, Aaron wanted to bring out the evil thoughts of the perpetrators into the open, so they could be identified and exterminated. Meaning, Aharon was aware that there were people that had improper thoughts and motivations, but we didn't know who they were. And over time, they could spread their poison and afflict Am Yisrael. It's kind of like the police who do an entrapment, right? The police, you know, want to see who's going to commit the crime. They offer drugs or whatever it is, then they arrest you without getting into the technicalities of that. Aharon wanted to bring out the evil machshava into Maaseh so that the perpetrators would be identified, punished, and not able to continue to be a bad influence on Am Yisrael. That's actually very, very fascinating. Let me mention that the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, takes this basic idea, but he gives a different twist. The Vilna Gaon says the following. God punishes, well, he gives a mashal, I'll just enter, he gives the following story. The king had a faithful servant, but the king was very volatile and lost his temper all the time. So the servant once, by accident, spilled a drop of water on the king, and the king started shouting, off with his head, kill him, kill him, kill him! So the servant took the whole tureen of soup and he dumped it on the king's head. So people said, why'd you do that? He says, I love the king so much, but if the king kills me because I spilled a drop of water, people are going to say the king is crazy or evil. So if the king is going to kill me, I want to give him a good reason. So people shouldn't think bad about the king. This is my love for the king, that if he's going to kill me, I don't want people to think the king is nuts. The Vilna Gaon says the following, listen to this. Avodah Zarah is one of the sins that God punishes evil intention, even if he didn't do an action. So the people who wanted to worship the golden calf would have died anyway. But since other people didn't know that they sinned, they would think God has no justice. So Aaron said, let them actually sin, so when they get killed, people will understand that God's justice is correct, rather than that, right? It's interesting. This is the Vilna Gaon compares it to the soup tureen and the king. But be this as it may, this idea of the Kuzari, that the Chet HaEgel was not mamish avodah zarah, is a very, very famous thought that's been picked up by many commentators. And in fact, he makes the point, I'm just kind of a little late, just one final point, 30 seconds. He makes the point that when we show a certain weakness, God will give us a way to indulge our weakness. And that is why after the ego, he gave us a Mishkan that is chock full of visual objects to focus our concentration. Because if we need, God will give. But you have to wait for the commandment. You can't do it on your own. And that's an important yesod, that God will give you spiritually as well as physically whatever it is you need, but you have to work within the parameters of the Torah. Anyway, I want to wish you all a Chag Sameach and a real Kabbalah to Torah.
Excuse me. I once read a book about, like, my source, a short biography of the customer.
Yes.
And that...